Morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to the oral arguments today. We have some special guests, Gateway Technical College students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. We have also Monticello High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you all for coming, and you may be seated, please. Students are here from the high school with a special program and a national award-winning program that's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. If they do decide to come, they're given materials about the case we're about to hear. They may engage in some activities relating to that case. They come and listen to an oral argument. And then at noon, after the second oral argument case is completed, the students will meet with the justice assigned for the day to meet with the students. And there's a discussion about the procedures of the court in taking, deciding, and then publishing opinions relating to the cases. There is no discussion of the substantive issues of the cases. And everyone is invited to join the students for that discussion. And it will take place roughly 12:15 or so in this courtroom. If anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, if you would raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. Well, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. She's the justice with whom you'll meet at noon today. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left is Justice Pat Robinsack. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will now call our first case today, 10 AP 1785, Joyce Aldridge versus Labor and Industry Review Commission. And I have here that Peter Reinhart, representing Ms. Aldridge, will have 25 minutes. Amy Schmidt-Jones will have 25 minutes representing Best Buy Stores. David Rice will have 5 minutes, Assistant Attorney General, representing the Wisconsin Labor and Industry Review Commission. And then, Mr. Reinhart, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Agreed? All right. Mr. Reinhart.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Pete Reinhart with the Bakke Norman Law Firm from Menominee, Wisconsin, and I represent Joyce Aldridge in this case. As I prepared for this argument today, I asked some of my colleagues in the firm to review the briefs, colleagues who aren't in the employment law area. And to one of them, they said, boy, this is really complicated, technical, and confusing. Technical rules, technical terms, and technical procedures. And that led me to say I want to make a few primary points what I think this case is really about. I want to part those waters of technical things to talk about what the case is about. First, this case is about a state statute, the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, and the purpose and design of that statute. The system under state law is specifically designed for lay people to file and pursue claims on their own without the assistance of an attorney. And I can tell you, I practice that in that area, and more often than not, that's what happens. Lay people file it on their own. The system is not supposed to be technical or confusing. The system is not supposed to emphasize form over substance. The statute, and I don't think there's any dispute about this, is a remedial statute to be liberally construed to resolve the problems it was designed to address. Joyce Aldrich was a layperson, and she followed all of the applicable rules, regulations, and procedures to try to commence her claim in a timely manner. She did everything asked of her and more. And she filed a document containing the information that needed to be contained in a timely manner. The third point, the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act is different and distinct from the federal laws. The Wisconsin Equal Rights Division has exclusive jurisdiction over the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act. Wisconsin courts decide what the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act means. Federal courts cannot decide what the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act means and did not do so in this case. Number four in my kind of overview, the federal decision by Judge Shabazz, upon which Best Buy and Lurk rely, was one interpretation or one view of what the federal law was at that time. And I don't think there's any dispute that the federal law at that time on the issue of can an intake questionnaire constitute a charge was unclear and unsettled, and the courts of appeals for the different federal circuits were divided, and actually into three different views, so much so that the United States Supreme Court had to weigh in on this decision or this issue and decide what the law meant, and it is our position in this case that under that Supreme Court decision, Federal Express v. Hallecki, there's no question that Ms. Aldrich's filings would have constituted a charge of discrimination. I also think, Justices, that it's important to put a human face on this, and so I'm going to just spend several brief moments saying things that are in the record but weren't necessarily in the brief. Ms. Aldrich began employment with Best Buy in 1987. She worked her way up through the management ranks at Best Buy, receiving six different promotions and also numerous pay increases. In 2003, a number of years after she had started employment, she was demoted. And she felt that demotion was discriminatory because there were numerous comments being made about her age, because there is a different application of work rules to her than to her younger male counterparts, and because her younger male counterparts were being treated in a number of different ways in a more favorable manner than she was. So at that time, she had claims under both federal law and state law. The state law is the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, but there are parallel provisions under federal law. Because she believed she was discriminated based on age and gender, she had claims under federal law under the Age Discrimination in Employment Act and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which covers gender discrimination. The laws are similar, but they are different. They are similar in that they prohibit the same discriminatory conduct. They share a 300-day statute of limitations, and in order to proceed with any claims under either set of laws, you have to start with an administrative agency. Under federal law, that's the EEOC. Under state law, that's the Equal Rights Division. They are different in the sense that each has their own set of administrative regulations. Each has its own set of case law interpreting the administrative regulations, and there are different remedies under the laws, and the federal laws have a private right of action and a right to a jury trial that you do not have under the state laws. The important distinction for purposes of this case, I believe, is you cannot pursue a federal claim in the Equal Rights Division. Can't be done. You cannot pursue a Wisconsin Fair Employment Act claim in federal court. Again, the Equal Rights Division has exclusive jurisdiction. So she was faced with, I have rights and remedies under state law. I have rights and remedies under federal law. They're not mutually exclusive. They can both be pursued. And she decided to file a claim with the EEOC. I think it's also important for the court to understand the process of filing a claim. And there's a process under state law, the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, and there's a process under federal law. Under state law, there are certain There are certain forms that you can fill out. You can, actually, now you can get online and get a form from the Equal Rights Division. You fill out some information and submit it. And the administrative regulations say to file a claim, it's on any form acceptable to the department. Case law tells us that that's very liberally construed, and case law even indicates, when I say case law, I'm talking about decisions of administrative law judges or LURC. That's what, I'm not talking about circuit court decisions or court of appeals. But case law also says even a letter alone can satisfy the statute of limitations. I would submit to the court that there's no question in this case that the intake questionnaire she submitted in a timely manner to the EEOC would have, had it been submitted to the Equal Rights Division, would have satisfied the statute of limitations. The federal process, however, is different. In the federal process, you contact the EEOC. The EEOC sends you a questionnaire. You fill out the questionnaire, send it back to the EEOC. The EEOC officer reviews it and calls you with some questions, and the EEOC officer has to prepare the quote-unquote formal charge of discrimination. So in other words, that process relies upon the EEOC officer to act in a timely and appropriate manner. Then there's the work-sharing agreement. And let me just, because I think that's important here. There is a work-sharing agreement between the Equal Rights Division and the EEOC. The purpose of that is to allow a person to file with one administrative agency, and then it's automatically filed with another. And it's not really any surprise. It's for efficiency, to avoid duplication, and for one agency to assume primary responsibility for the investigation, although you can cross back and forth and say, I want the investigation transferred from the EEOC to the Equal Rights Division.
Counselor, I'd like you to talk about that a little bit more. I pulled that out because I hadn't looked at it in a number of years. And I didn't find anything that said just filing it with the EEOC was sufficient to cause a filing with the ERD. Is there something that I'm missing in there on that, in that regard? I know they eventually sent the charge over physically.
It's not in there. I've looked through it too.
Okay.
I agree with your analysis completely. Where you get that from is 218.035, mm-hmm. which states a complaint is timely, a complaint that is deferred to another agency, or to the ERD, which really means referred to the ERD by another agency, is timely filed when physically received by the other agency.
Right. So if you're looking at that, it's not filed with the ERD until they send the charge over, right?
No, I would not agree. If you look at,
okay.
I would respectfully disagree.
That's fine. I'm trying to get it sorted out, so I don't mind your disagreeing.
It's 218.035.
Yeah, I wrote that down.
A complaint which is deferred to the department by a federal or local employment opportunity agency with which the department has a work-sharing agreement, complies with the requirements of sub 3, and is considered filed when received by the federal or local agency. In other words, when it is filed, when a complaint is filed with the federal agency, that satisfies the statute of limitations.
But sub 6 of 218.02 says filing means physical receipt of a document, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so what 5 does is say, well, we didn't ever get it, but if they got it, it's good enough for us.
Otherwise, it wouldn't make any sense. Otherwise, you would be reading that statute, 218.0305, out of it. That's right, because you're agreeing that one has primary responsibility. The problem with talking about physical receipt is, okay, we timely file with the EEOC, and what if the EEOC sits on it for 6 months or a year and there's a bureaucratic oversight or mistake? Are you then out of luck?
Well, the problem here is that ultimately the charge under the federal system was deemed late, right?
That's correct.
And when they finally got around to writing up the charge, it was late. And they sent it, as soon as they did do the charge, they sent it to the state, right? And it was late. 300 days, It's more than 300 days at the feds, and it was more than 300 days in the state.
The charge was.
The charge was. So how do you get around that problem?
Well, how I get around that problem is under the administrative regulations. Well, there's two ways. But under the administrative regulations, we're talking about a complaint.
Right.
Not a charge. A complaint is a defined term that has a specific meaning.
All right.
She filed an intake questionnaire that was more than timely and had much more information than the actual formal charge that was prepared. It's ironic because if you compare the intake questionnaire to the formal charge, federal charge, it's 8 pages and has detailed information.
So you're saying a paper that would constitute a complaint under the state statute and regulations was filed timely at the federal government?
No question about it.
And even if the charge was not filed timely for the feds, the complaint was filed timely with the feds, and ultimately you got the file.
Yes.
I don't mean you. I mean Mr. Rice got the file. Well, but that really mucks things up, doesn't it? Because it means that the state agency has to always look at the federal filings and say, oh, well, it may not have fit the federal, it fits the state. I mean, the whole point of this is simplicity, or one point of it is simplicity. That you don't make it very simple, and it could sit for 2, 3, 4 years
well,
at the EEOC, and you wouldn't even know anything about it. I mean Mr. Rice.
There's always that slippery slope argument, but that's not what happened here. I understand people can argue, well, geez, this could end up in a system where something sits there forever. But as a practical matter, that's not what happened in this case, and I don't think that's likely to happen. I do know what the language of the administrative regulations say, and I go back to that. They specifically use the term complaint, not charge. And I do know that the interpretation that is proposed by Best Buy and Lurk wants to read that language complaint out and put in the language charge. And I think that's problematic for that position.
Counselor, was the charge questionnaire ever filed with the ERD?
No, it was not.
So the only thing that they're working off of is the charge?
Is the formal charge, that's correct.
Were her corrections to that charge, and what interests me most is she sent to the EEOC corrections to the charge of discrimination, and the second one said dates of discrimination are 8/14/2002 and still ongoing.
Right.
And that still ongoing, to me, brings to mind course of conduct, which can have a big impact on the timeliness of complaints. And no one talks to us about that. Is that not anything we should be considering?
You mean a continuing violation issue?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, let me try to go back in memory.
But let's answer. I asked you too many questions, but I need just to go one by one. Was her corrections to the charge, were those ever filed with the ERD?
No.
Okay. All right. And then now you can talk about this continuing.
They were sent to the EEOC.
Right, that I know.
And the reason they weren't included in the formal charge of discrimination is because of that 5-month lag, and the constructive discharge had occurred during that time period. But why didn't continuing violation come up?
She said a continuing violation long before she was discharged. That's in her questionnaire. It's not in the complaint, but she said that right from the get-go, and that it ended up with what she says is a constructive discharge is not something new that just occurred at that time.
Well, how I analyzed it, Your Honor, was you need to have a tangible adverse employment action. Demotion was a tangible adverse employment action. constructive discharge is a tangible adverse employment action. In between, if there's continuing comments or so forth, they're only actionable if, one, they constitute harassment, which has to be more than a few stray comments, or, two, they constitute a tangible adverse employment action. And so when she brought up continuing violation, and the case was actually with me, I looked at that and I analyzed it from that framework. Is there a tangible adverse employment action which is actionable? Being aware of the fact that under harassment law, it has to be severe and ongoing and affect your employment. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. Okay, thank you.
Counsel, it seems to me that a lot of the focus in this case is on what has already been touched upon, the Wisconsin Administrative Code 218.03 sub 5. And that provision states in part, begins with, a complaint which is deferred to the department by a federal or local employment opportunity agency with which the department has a work-sharing agreement complies with the requirement of sub 3, the form and content of the complaint, and is considered filed when received by the federal or local agency. I said in part, but I read the whole thing. The focus is twofold. Number one, it says a complaint, and I think there's a disagreement between the parties here as to whether a complaint means a complaint under state law or whether that really is tantamount to a charge under federal law.
Agreed.
The other focus of disagreement is on the word deferred. What does it mean to be deferred? As I understand the differences, that your Best Buy, at least, suggests that deferred means to send to and receive. That's in their brief, if I read it correctly. And that you have a broader approach to that definition, and that is that it's kind of the overall complaint, if I get it correctly, as opposed to it doesn't require any physical delivery of something, but it's rather you're dealing with the totality of the complaint.
Deferred is, in my opinion, perhaps it probably wasn't the best word to use there. What does it mean? Our argument is what it means is when somebody else is the initial administrative agency that intakes the complaint is then referred, is perhaps a better word, to the ERD. In other words, it's referring to a situation where the Equal Rights Division is not the first one who received it or is the one who is going to be investigating it.
I smile because when I was preparing for this case, the first thing, and I was reading things about it, and I got to the word deferred, and I, as I do, edit things, and I edited it, and I put an R there as though it really meant referred, but indeed it means defer. That's what the rule says. But so both sides argued that what defer means is plain. Both of you argue it's plain language interpretation. But it seems to me that's central to the issue. Am I missing something? Help me with that.
I will tell you my fallback position. Again, as I prepared for this case, we have two sides saying, look at the express language and the plain meaning, and it supports our position. Well, I think the court could reasonably decide that this is ambiguous. And then you go into the rules about what do you do when a statute is ambiguous and you look at the intent and the purpose of the statute. And I say if we go down that path, it's not a close call anymore. It's a remedial statute. It's to be construed to effectuate the purposes, liberally construed to effectuate the purposes of the Act. And I can't imagine any argument that denying somebody who's done everything they can to pursue their claims and isn't able to pursue them because of bureaucratic omission or oversight or delay, denying her rights would be in accordance with the purpose of the act. I see I'm running short on time, so I just want...
We have two more issues.
What's that?
You have two more issues.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about issue preclusion just briefly. I'm not going to go through the law of issue preclusion. This court is very well familiar and has decided a number of cases. I do want to stress what I think is the dispositive or key factor in issue preclusion, and that is the intervening change in the law, and that's the Federal Express versus Hulwecki case. And this was the very dispute in that case. The Supreme Court said, we have these situations where people are submitting intake questionnaires. There's no definition of charge, so we're going to come up with a uniform standard for when something is a charge, and it was decided in the context of this very issue when an intake questionnaire is submitted. And the court came up with a permissive uniform standard, which said if we look at this objectively, and one would conclude that the person making the filing at issue was trying to initiate the enforcement mechanism of the act, it satisfies and is a charge. And I would submit to you, if you look at what she submitted under Hulwecki, there's no question that this would have been a charge under the Hulwecki case. Now, I understand Best Buy and Lurk have said, well, it's really not a change in the Seventh Circuit law, so it's not an intervening change in the law. I have briefed that and kind of lived it. I will say that there were the Steffens case, which is kind of the case that was cited in the Hulwecki case, and that was really a more subjective analysis focusing on the intent of the filer and how the EEOC treated it. But that wasn't the case that Judge Shabazz based his decision on. He based his decision on the Perkins case, which said if the EEOC contacts the person and says they need more information to prepare a charge, and under that situation, the intake questionnaire can't constitute a charge. Regardless, all that's gone away with Hulwecki. Hulwecki has said, here's the standard that we apply now. And so if you look at what the law was intended to be, her complaint, her intake questionnaire would have been a charge. And I'd all, go ahead. Did you have?
Well, problem is this. The law changes, sometimes very slowly and incrementally, and sometimes dramatically, sometimes in between, right? And we've had situations where in year one we don't take a case on a petition for review, and then in year two or three we do take the case and we rule in a way that made the first case that we didn't take wrong. But we don't allow in the law to go back. We don't go to that first case that we didn't take and they come in and say, see, we're right. Fix it up for us, right? We say the end, finality, and you go forth. So if we accept your view on preclusion, what we're saying is, hey, cases came up after Judge Shabazz ruled, right? You're saying Judge Shabazz, under the U.S. Supreme Court decision, in your opinion, he was wrong, your client was right, and we should fix it up. What does that do with finality?
I note that I'm on red. Can I answer
your
question?
You can answer, yes.
Well, I would make two points to that. One, I know that was brought up by the other side, and in terms of federal law and finality, and I will say there is a federal case from, I can't recall the year, I think it's the Harper case that says when there is a change, when the U.S. Supreme Court talks to a change in the law or has a holding on a point of law, that is applied retroactively regardless of the equities of the situation. I would note, in the interest of kind of full disclosure, I think you, Judge, have wrote a decision, and I don't know that Wisconsin has completely adopted the Harper case. I can't recall the date of the decision. I think it was 2007, and kind of said, well, we're going to do kind of our own analysis under the Chevron case, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. But my answer is, if the U.S. Supreme Court is deciding the case on a point of law, it should be applied retroactively.
There's an exception about the finality issue, and that's with cases in the pipeline.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering whether you consider this in the pipeline. Now, it's in the wrong pipeline. It's in the state pipeline rather than the federal pipeline.
It was in the pipeline. It's important for you to understand her Equal Rights Division case was never dismissed. It was always alive. And this case has been in the pipeline.
In the state courts, it's
right.
Never been dismissed.
From 2004 through the current time, it's always been alive.
Counsel, I understood your argument in regard to Hawecki to go to one of the factors that a court has to consider with issue preclusion, which goes to whether there's been a intervening contextual shift in the law. And that's how I understood you to be asking us to consider the Federal Express v. Hawecki case.
That's correct, Judge. And the only thing, the other thing I'd mention is there is some argument, as I said, about whether it is a change in the law. And I have cited subsequent seven. I went through my analysis of the Seventh Circuit law prior to Hawecki and then after Hawecki. And the case I cited makes it clear that the Seventh Circuit does approach things different after Hawecki.
Now, that goes to the second part of issue preclusion, namely the discretion of LIRC. That's what we're reviewing, right? In terms of a change in the law, that's part of the discretionary decision of LIRC on preemption.
In terms of the standard of review, Judge?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I believe under the intervening contextual change in the law, that's a de novo issue.
Well, I suppose it's de novo as to whether there's a change in the law. That's a legal issue, but whether or not it goes to fundamental fairness for preclusion, be discretionary.
I'm not sure I entirely agree with you on that.
All right, well, you don't have to. I think you're better off taking the other route because it's harder to overturn a discretionary issue.
I'm sorry, Judge.
It's harder to overturn a discretionary decision.
It is harder to overturn a discretionary decision, but I don't think in this case there's any... The exercise of there's no rational basis for the exercise of the discretion when you look at the Hawecki case and what the law was before and what the law was after.
Well, Mr. Reinhart, thank you, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Attorney Amy Schmidt-Jones, representing Best Buy Stores.
May it please the court and opposing counsel. I am Amy Schmidt-Jones from Michael Best and Friedrich, and we represent the respondent, Best Buy Stores, LLP. I'd like actually to start with one of the issues that was raised in the questioning of opposing counsel, which is what happens to finality in this case if we accept the arguments of Joyce Aldrich and we revisit the question of whether her charge filed with the EEOC was timely charged. What happens to finality? Well, the result would be there'd be a finding from a Wisconsin court on a question of fact, the date a document was filed, which will be contradictory to a federal court judgment. There'll be a finding from this court as to whether whether an intake questionnaire constituted a charge, which also will conflict with a federal court judgment. There'll be a finding by this court as to whether constructive discharge was in a charge, contradictory to what a federal court found. There'll be a question with respect to whether the more charges of discrimination form even articulated constructive discharge, contrary to what a federal district court found. That is what issue preclusion is designed to protect. The Harper decision cited by opposing counsel was not a preclusion case. It came up for the first time in his reply brief. And there's a U.S. Supreme Court case which talks about issue preclusion in the context of someone who doesn't appeal. And that case is Federated Department Stores versus Moiety, 452 U.S. 394. And in that case, there were five plaintiffs, only three of whom appealed. And the other two decided to file a state court action and pursue their claim that way. And after they did that, there was an intervening change in the law. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, this is exactly what issue preclusion exists for. If you sit on your hands and you don't appeal, that is the decision you made. We can't have contradictory findings in the same case on the same set of facts from two separate courts.
What about the exception of in the pipeline?
We don't agree that this case was in the pipeline. Harper specifically talks about cases on direct review. Mm-hmm. This is not a direct review of those particular issues. This is a collateral review of those issues. So we don't agree that this case was in the pipeline in the sense that you can have contradictory findings of fact made. And that's what makes this case, in terms of the intervening change in law exception to issue preclusion, our understanding is that exception really exists for those cases where you have a litigation where a finding of law was made. And keep in mind, we have findings of fact and law made by the district court here, where there's a finding of law that's made, and then there's a different case that's brought involving the same parties, and the law has changed. So that if you hold the parties to the prior interpretation of law, in the second case, they're going to be standing in a disparate fashion to other litigants litigating at the same time.
Counsel, you preface, and you had a nice introduction, you preface that by talking about inconsistent findings of fact, and yet it seems to me that implicit, if there was a finding of fact, are the legal determinations that we must address here. Is a questionnaire a complaint? You know, what's the difference between a questionnaire, complaint, and charge? Before we can determine if they're inconsistent, we have to address some of those legal questions. It seems to me, which I'm going to segue into, standard of review on issue preclusion.
Okay. Going back to the standard of review, and I would say there are two points to be made with respect to the standard of review, because this case is, at its core, a statutory interpretation case.
That's right.
With respect to statutory interpretation, I think all of the colleagues that have had to read all the briefs in this case, as we prepared for this argument, I liked the phrase used by opposing counsel, complicated, technical, and confusing. I think we all heard that. And the Labor and Industry Review Commission is the commission that understands this process. I mean, the department is charged with implementing the statute, implementing the regulations. They understand the work-sharing agreement intimately and how it works, and the commission understands the harm that will flow from a scheme that's put forward by Ms. Aldrich that would allow this after-the-fact analysis of documents that were never submitted to the Equal Rights Division. So for all of those reasons, this is a case where there should be great weight deference to the commission.
Page 26, however, of the brief of the commission states as follows. The commission acknowledges, however, that whether the commission properly applied the doctrine of issue preclusion is subject to de novo review
by
the circuit court.
And respectfully, in our brief, we did not accept that broad conclusion. As I understand the Estate v. Riley case, which was issued by this court and is cited in our brief, the fundamental elements of issue preclusion, whether you have identity of issues, whether those issues were litigated and essential to the judgment, that is evaluated under a de novo standard. But as the Chief Justice articulated in the decision, the fundamental fairness analysis includes both issues of law and issues of discretion. And on the points and on the weighing of the factors and on the points going to discretion, those are reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard.
It sounds to me a little unusual with the argument that the commission has all this experience and therefore you should defer to it when the commission is saying de novo review.
Under issue preclusion.
Under issue preclusion, that's correct.
Right. But with respect to the construction of the statute, I believe the commission has also taken the position that should be given great weight deference.
That's right, with regard to the construction of the statute.
Right.
That's right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand the commission's position, which you've stated, namely that the commission should determine what's a charge and complaint and what the working work share relationship is and how that goes into effect. And that those are everyday kinds of concerns, and that the commission might not want to go back and have to look through the federal file to see whether there's been a state complaint filed earlier than the charge. For administrative convenience kind of considerations. But on the issue preclusion, where you have a change or potential change, there's a dispute about that, in the law in the federal system, and now it's before the state court relating to this federal law, it doesn't affect the commission to have preclusion here on the grounds that it's fundamentally fair because there's been a change in the federal law. Even if she had appealed, her appeal might not have gone up and been finished by the time the new case came down from the U.S. Supreme Court. So what's the matter with issue preclusion in this state, in this case?
What's the matter with
yes.
not applying it or with applying
with
it?
With not applying it. I know you want to apply. You think that's honky-dory.
What's that? Excuse me?
I said you think that's swell.
Yes, that's correct. We would think it's swell. The harm with not applying issue preclusion in this case, I mean, there are a number of harms that would flow from the interpretation that's put forward by Ms. Aldrich. First of all, I mean, we've articulated in our brief pretty clearly, I hope, the statutory language and regulatory language that we think supports the single data filing rule. That's what I'm going to call the commission's interpretation. Basically, the commission says we're going to have a single data filing. The date the charge is filed with the EEOC, as determined under federal law, is going to be the date the Equal Rights Division complaint is filed. And that reflects both that the statute itself talks about the fact that a complaint must be filed with the department, that filing equals physical receipt by the department. And then in this context of cross-filing, the deferral statute says that when a complaint is deferred, and we do interpret that to mean sent to and received by the Equal Rights Division from the EEOC, when we have it, it's going to be deemed to comply with our form and content requirements, and we will deem it filed when it was received by the federal agency. So we think the clear statutes regs support this single data filing rule. What's the harm if we grant an exception in this case? There are several ways there's a harm. And I with respect to the remedial purposes of the statute, the 300-day statute of limitations reflects and supports the remedial purposes of the statute. It reflects that in these employment cases, they need to be brought quickly and they need to be adjudicated quickly. You're talking about people who may be in current employment situations or who maybe need to be returned to work. These are cases that need to be moved along. If we have a situation where now a document that the Equal Rights Division never received and that the EEOC did not consider a charge and a federal court said it's not a charge, if we have a situation where we have to go back now and the Equal Rights Division investigators have to go rummaging through their files, it does muck things up, to use the phrase used by the Chief Justice. In addition, you could have a situation where a complainant goes to the EEOC, fills out an intake questionnaire, and decides never to perfect a charge. So they just never finish with the process. And Holowecki tells us that's a function of the EEOC, not just to enforce, but to provide information and education.
But, Counselor, doesn't the fairness of this case kind of get to you a little bit? She brought it on time, and the EEOC employees did not proceed on it.
All of those facts were litigated before the federal district court. At the end of the
EEOC
process.
I'm worrying about relitigating them. I'm worrying about how fundamental a fairness, which is the standard about whether issue preclusion should be applied in an individual case, might be affected by the fact that all of this is late, not due to her fault, but due to employees of the EEOC.
We don't agree that it was due to no fault on her part. If you review her affidavit, she got the intake questionnaire in March and she waited 5 months to file it. if Ms. Aldrich has moved more quickly, she can't say she bears no responsibility for what happened.
Well, she certainly was well within the 300 days to have filed it in 5 months, correct?
When she filed her intake questionnaire.
That's right. She has no control over filing the charge, none.
But she does have control with filing with the Equal Rights Division, which she could have done at any time.
Yeah, you're right. She could have filed both places. I agree.
So what I was going to say was, if you have an individual who files an intake questionnaire, never perfects a charge, what's to stop them from coming back in 3 years to the Equal Rights Division and saying, I'd like to pursue my complaint now?
That's not this case. That is
that,
not this
but
case.
That is what it would open the door. If you say that we're going to assess the statute of limitations based on whether a document the Equal Rights Division never received meets the form and content requirements.
I think you misunderstand the focus of my concern. The focus of my concern is simply whether I think that issue preclusion should or should not be applied in this case. And you can meet all the requirements where you could apply it, but in fundamental fairness, perhaps in this case, it should not be applied. That's really my major concern.
Our understanding of fundamental fairness, as articulated in prior decisions of this court, is not, would it be fair to give this woman a hearing? That's not the standard of fundamental fairness. Fundamental fairness goes to due process and whether in the prior case the person had the opportunity to fully and fairly litigate. And that's unquestionably true in this case.
Well, it would have been unquestionably true if the EEOC had gotten busy and issued the charge with even 2 months after she provided the material, or 3 months after she provided the material, or 4 months after she provided the material, or 5 months after she provided the material. You know, I don't know if she has a meritorious claim or not, but I am clearly troubled by why it's late.
But to undo, based on the circumstances of one individual person, the effect of adopting that type of interpretation of the statute, or to undo and say, we're going to make an exception in her one case, that's not the way issue preclusion is supposed to operate.
Well, Ms. Jones, that's why I've asked you to concentrate on preclusion. Because, the U.S. Supreme Court case and the strange circumstances here, that doesn't happen every day. When you look to the statute and interpret the rules, subsection 5, then you're affecting a great number of people, and the whole way maybe that the Equal Rights Division does its business. I mean, that's what I hear you saying. But not on the basis of preclusion and the facts in this particular case.
With respect to the issue of preclusion, we do not agree that the law changed in a way that would impact Ms. Aldrich. We do not agree that Holowecki altered the standard in the Seventh Circuit. The Steffen decision that's cited in the briefs articulated an objective, reasonable person standard for assessing whether an intake questionnaire is a charge. In addition, Steffen clearly held that the actions of the EEOC are not determinative as to whether an intake questionnaire is going to be deemed to be a charge. That was the standard in place. If you run Shepherds on Steffen, Philbin, Perkins, any of the cases that were cited in the briefs or that were relied upon by the district court, they do not come up as overruled. And on top of that, we also do not agree that it's a given that under Holowecki, Ms. Aldrich's charge or her intake questionnaire would be considered to be a charge. If you read Holowecki, the identical form number was at issue in Holowecki. It was the same form number that she filled out, that Ms. Aldrich filled out. In Holowecki, the Supreme Court, it wasn't a holding, but they said if this was all we had before us, we might agree this isn't enough to be a charge under federal law because it doesn't contain a clear request for action. It's the same form that Ms. Aldrich filled out. What tipped the balance in Holowecki for the Supreme Court were two things. One was a multi-page affidavit from the complainant, the end of which she said, please make them stop discriminating, a statement to that effect. And secondly, she checked a box indicating that they could go ahead and notify her employer. And those two pieces of information were critical to the Supreme Court in Holowecki in finding that in that particular instance, looking at that filing, they would consider the intake questionnaire to be a charge. We don't have that here. All we have are the questionnaires. There's no request for action. All the fine print is the same on the forms. It says this form is for purposes of assessing jurisdiction. It says this form is for purposes of pre-charge counseling. So it's not at all a given that Holowecki would alter anything if the issue was to be considered fresh.
So your position is if she filed exactly what she filed now and it was not filed within 300 days with the ERD or with the EEOC for a charge, that her questionnaire would still be insufficient under Holowecki? So you don't think it would make any difference if Holowecki had been in effect all the way through?
Correct. Shabazz could have reached the same decision.
Counsel, both you and opposing counsel began your comments this morning with explaining or editorializing that this is a complex technical case. One simple approach with regard to issue one is something we have used time and time again. You look at the statute. Are the words ambiguous? Here we have words, and especially I focus on the word defer. We have two what arguably could be reasonable interpretations. I mean, when you look at the word defer, you are talking about received and
Sent.
That's the way you are interpreting the word defer. I mean, if I went to a dictionary and I looked up the word defer, I bet you I wouldn't find received and sent. So I've got a little problem with the whole plain meaning argument, because defer doesn't mean that. You can interpret it to mean that by looking, using our interpretive tools, but no one on the street would come up with that definition of defer. So what's tried and true is this. You've got one side that interprets defer more broadly. You interpret it more narrowly. The term is ambiguous. Defer, in my mind, doesn't mean what either of you are really necessarily saying, but maybe. So it's ambiguous, and this is a remedial statute. Tie goes to the complainant. That's real simple. That's something we do lots of times. Why shouldn't we do that here on the first issue? And then, of course, as I understand it, if you answer the first issue where the plaintiff would prevail, you don't even get to the other issues. So why shouldn't we take this tried and true simple approach?
Well, first, we have the interpretation from an agency that is also entitled to deference. I mean, we have the interpretation from the agency that works in this context. It's not just a clean question where it's a statutory provision where there hasn't been an interpretation put forward by an agency.
I'm not so sure that that is the standard of review. In the Kite case, which we had here, you know, a few years ago, I can't remember exactly, it addressed the standard of review, and it was talking about this premise of standard review. Hey, this stuff is jurisdictional, right? Whether or not you have jurisdiction. And when a commission or entity interprets its own powers, we don't give any deference to an interpretation of their own powers. This is an exception to the deference rule. And, in fact, we interpret stuff de novo.
My understanding, Your Honor, is that a statute of limitations is not jurisdictional, that a statute of limitations is a condition precedent, something subject to tolling, that it's not jurisdictional. It doesn't determine the jurisdiction of the agency.
Could be. I just don't know that right offhand. That I guess it oftentimes as happens frequently, depending on how broadly you look at the issue. If you look at the issue in terms of the administrative rule and what it takes to invoke the jurisdiction of the agency, and that is the filing of a complaint,
I'm just not sure about jurisdiction. But you might be right on that, that this would be unlike the Kite case.
That's my understanding.
Mm-hmm. I'll check further. That's right. Okay, so again, back to the question of why not keep it simple. Both interpretations are reasonable. Tie goes to the plaintiff.
I think we would say if you're looking to effectuate the remedial purposes of the statute, it's not just make sure everyone gets relief. We have a statute of limitations here, and the statute of limitations exists for a reason which articulated below. So in this particular instance, you have a reasonable interpretation of the statute by the implementing agency. And on top of that, you have many things that would not effectuate the purposes of the statute if you went down that road and took that interpretation. So you could have people coming back to the Equal Rights Division years after the fact saying, I filed this intake questionnaire at the EEOC, I'd like to proceed now, if it never resulted in a charge.
You're now going, I think what I would hear is absurd results. You know, in other words,
they
don't interpret absurd results to take their interpretation.
I think that would be an absurd result because basically instead of having a 300-day statute of limitations, we'd be talking about a lot of laches cases, and everyone would be decided differently based on the facts of the case. And that's not something that facilitates this process that you do want to keep simple. And the single data filing rule is simple. It is consistent with the language of the statute.
That's probably, to my ear, a better argument, because when you start going to purpose, boy, you've got a lot of cases, although it interprets the EEOC, the Holowecki case has some wonderful language about the remedial purpose of that, the federal scheme. You know, it would be illogical and impractical to make the definition of charge dependent upon a condition subsequent over which the parties have no control, or the system has to be set up to be accessible to individuals who have no detailed knowledge of the mechanisms and agency processes. So then it boils down to which purpose are we going to choose? You know, because you have some purposes, but there are other kinds of purposes too.
You choose the purpose that ensures that the system will provide relief speedily to the greatest number of people. You don't make the exceptions for the one tough case. And the Holowecki case also spoke about the reason why they make the distinction between charge and complaint, which is that the EEOC serves this information-giving function. So the EEOC does not want to be in a position that everything they get needs to be considered a charge, whereas this interpretation would be at odds with that, would be in tension with that. I mean, the EEOC's regulations say when you receive something, we consider it a charge, even if it doesn't, they don't do the independent analysis to say, did that WFEA complaint indicate an objective intent to activate the machinery? They just say, if you got it, we got it. And the commission has said, if they got it, we got it.
So the feds say if it's a good enough complaint for the state, they won't review it again to see if it's a good enough charge for the feds?
My understanding under the ADEA regulations in particular, if a charge is filed with the Fair Employment Agency, it's deemed to be filed with the feds. And I believe that's cited in the Cook decision.
Even though it doesn't meet all the criteria for a charge in the federal system?
Correct. That's my understanding. And just briefly, I wanted to touch on something that hasn't been discussed much today, which is the constructive discharge claim. That put my yellow lights on, so I'll keep it brief. An important fact to understand there is Ms. Aldrich signed her charge after her constructive discharge, so she knew about the claim at the time she filled out her charge. And again, the only document that went over to the Equal Rights Division was the charge, so the Equal Rights Division never had any notice of a constructive discharge claim. That was clear at the point of the investigation, the initial determination. It was clear at the point a notice of hearing was articulated. It was never investigated. And by the time Ms. Aldrich started saying it should be included here, it was well time-barred, years time-barred. So I'm on red, so I'm going to sit down.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney David C. Rice, Assistant Attorney General, representing LIRC.
May it please the members of the court, Chief. I am David Rice. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and in this case, I appear on behalf of the Labor and Industry Review Commission. I have but 5 minutes. I want to make 2 points, and I state them first. We just don't want you to do any harm with your decision, either to the work
do
sharing.
No harm.
Is that the, that's the rule of law?
Like a doctor.
Right, okay.
So the work sharing agreement works well overall. I'll explain why. We don't want you to adopt the position urged by Aldrich's attorney because it would muck up the system for reasons I'll explain. And then secondly, we don't want you to make errors in preclusion law that are going to be matters that go beyond this case. So I'll get to preclusion law first. If you're going to apply preclusion law and you're going to rule in favor of Ms. Aldrich, then please rely only on the fifth factor that's identified in your cases, the kind of catch-all. It wouldn't be fair. Don't rely on the exception about intervening changes in the contextual changes of the law. You know, in my brief, I didn't even understand this, I think, till last night. I tried to argue whether Holowecki was or wasn't a change from Stephan, but that really doesn't matter. Let's assume that it was a significant change. That still doesn't matter for purposes of preclusion doctrine. And I urge you to take a look at the cases that are cited in the brief of Best Buy. O'Leary versus Liberty Mutual, which is a Third Circuit case, and Morgan versus Department of Energy. In O'Leary, the court, in a footnote, says that when they searched the law in 1991, there was only 12 cases, state or federal, that addressed the meaning of the restatement paragraph. But what that both courts conclude is not only must there be a change in the law, but it has to be applied to a different set of facts. So I just urge you, when you're writing your decision on preclusion, look at those cases and don't ground your decision on this contextual change in the law because it will do damage to preclusion law in ways that are unintended for other cases. Okay, let's talk about the work-sharing agreement, and let's talk about the agreement to start with. Justice Rogensack asked about that and about the language. It is contained, the work-sharing agreement is contained in the appendix to Best Buy's Court of Appeals brief. It's also in the record at 4.70, pages 44 to 84, it's Exhibit A to the second motion to dismiss filed by Best Buy. If you look at the agreement, it specifically says, and I'm looking at section Roman numeral 2 of the agreement, in order to facilitate the assertion of employment rights, the EEOC and the FEPA, well, this is a federal generated form, but it's the Equal Rights Division of Wisconsin, each designate the other as its agent for the purpose of receiving and drafting charges. EEOC's receipt of charges on the FEPA's behalf will automatically initiate the proceedings of both EEOC and state law. That's the question you asked. Okay, so in general, the work-sharing agreement works well. Most cases, we don't have these statute of limitations issues. They're filed with one agency, and one of the agencies works on it, the other agency defers, and we'll get to what defers means. And they do workload division, and that makes sense. So that's the system we want to keep in place. That's why if the worst case scenario for the commission and for the state would be if you adopt this argument that if you file a document with the federal government that meets the state law requirements, that's adequate. That's the argument that you shouldn't adopt. If you're going to adopt an argument on the work-sharing agreement, then you get to the question of the section that you're talking about, 218, I forget what it is, but it's the section about a complaint being deferred pursuant to a work-sharing agreement. Well, that section's ambiguous. You can't just look at the word complaint. You have to look at it in context of work-sharing agreement. If you look at work-sharing agreement, that only uses the word charge because that's the federal nomenclature. Wisconsin, I looked at it today, back in 1945 when the law was first enacted, language has been the same. The department may receive, or it was then the Industrial Commission, may receive a complaint charging discrimination. That's what the law says today. But you can't construe the word complaint, I think, other than in the context of work-sharing agreements, Justice Bradley, so that I think it has to mean either charge or complaint, and it applies equally to Madison Ordinance, which uses the word complaint.
That would be an odd tool of construction. We have tools of construction, and to interpret this word of the statute, we look to some private contract or some public contract.
My red light's on. May I answer the question?
You may answer that.
That's the But there is that language, so it has to have some meaning. It's not just surplusage.
Which language?
The work sharing language.
I know, but counsel, you're asking us to define a statute, which is another way of stating what Justice Bradley said. You're asking us to define the statute in terms of an agreement that the department reached with a federal agency. And what comes to mind of somebody who sits on the bench is, hey, you made a bad arrangement. It doesn't fit the statute. I mean, and that's what you don't want us to say.
Well, that's true. But how can you construe the word complaint and deferral of a complaint with an agency with whom the department has a work-sharing agreement if you don't know anything about the work-sharing agreement?
Well,
I get your point. I mean, it's not that I don't understand what you're saying.
And if I understand the point you're making, it's at page 31 of your brief in that last paragraph that says the system, although it may be a tight fit into the shoe of the statute, those are my words, and the regulations, it does work. And if you have a case that has a fairness issue, and court, you are inclined to say, let's hold for the person who claims discrimination, do it under fairness rather than on a interpretation of 218.035. That's your point.
Right.
Now, why is it so tough for you if we say that we are looking at complaint. We're going to look at the federal file. You should look at the federal file. And is there a document in there within the first 300 days that fits the definition of complaint in our statute? Or rules, I'm sorry. What's so hard?
Well, because the way the system works now, it's based mostly on when the charge is filed. And we don't have to examine, nor does EEOC have to examine whether the complaint meets some state law requirements.
You've deferred to the feds.
Well, yes and no. And this, I just wanted to say one thing, because I think this is the question you asked, Justice Bradley. And this is maybe where we have some disagreement and maybe why this is confusing. In the Mill Run case, there's going to be a deferred complaint. They're going to be filed in both places. And there's not going to be a statute of limitations. The only reason that this whole intake questionnaire ever comes up is when the respondent gets the complaint and they raise a statute of limitations defense. And then in response to the statute of limitations defense, the person says, true, my charge didn't meet the 300 days, but I filed this other document that did. And in the commission's earlier decision in KEP, which I cite, if it's an unresolved issue, the commission's willing to tackle that federal question and say, you're right, that should have, under Holowecki, that should have been deemed a federal charge, and so we'll treat it as being a timely federal charge, which makes it a timely state charge. But that's what's difficult, because how do you defer something which you never got? But it doesn't become important until, in the administrative proceeding, somebody raises the statute of limitations, and then that triggers the issue. So that's why I think it's the only point which we have maybe some dispute is how does it work when you don't literally get that document, that intake questionnaire, because you'd be of no reason to get it unless the employer raises the statute of limitations defense.
The two cases you cite are not like this case, because in those cases the feds didn't reach a conclusion of whether it was or wasn't a charge. So it came to the Equal Rights Division. Unlike this case, where the feds did reach a decision.
Right. Okay. What makes this difference, I mean, the commission had Judge Shabazz not ruled, then under KEP, the commission would have ruled as to whether the intake questionnaire met the criteria. And you wouldn't have a preclusion.
Have a preclusion, right. And so the commission does rule on these issues.
Well, it did in KEP, and I assume that it would continue to
otherwise,
do that.
Otherwise, yeah. And it's preclusion. And whether you'll accept the feds, which you generally do, and they accept your decision as to whether it's a complaint.
And I think, you know, I've expressed it many times that I don't truly believe that cases are decided based on standard of review, but I meant what I said. I mean, I think on preclusion, generally courts are in a better position than agencies to make those decisions.
I think it's a question of law or discretion on preclusion? Or both?
If you look at your cases, it's a question of law whether there was the prior case and whether
right.
the new case.
That's the first aspect.
That's the first part. The second part says it's discretionary somehow overall, but then it says elements within that can be questions of law. Mm-hmm. And I think at least on the contextual shift change, that's got to be a question of law. Mm-hmm. On the last one, the fairness thing, that likely is a discretionary issue.
Arms are being tested. It's not a fire drill.
I jump every time. When I got that thing, I still jump. I have that in front of me, and I still jump. Yeah, well, they turned it down. That's fine. It really gets your attention.
They're not as loud as usual.
Didn't do me any good.
They're doing better.
Oh, that's loud enough for me.
I'm sorry, I should have interrupted Mr. Rice and told you that that was going to happen.
Yeah. We were all instructed by the marshal before you.
Oh, good. All right. Are there any further questions? Justice Prosser.
Wisconsin Administrative Code 218.035 refers not only to a federal agency, but to a local employment opportunity agency. What is that?
That and would be like the Madison Equal Opportunities Commission.
Does the work sharing agreement that you alluded to cover the local agency?
They're separate agreements, one between the state and the federal government, one between the state and the city.
And are there the same definitions in the local?
The state law and the municipal ordinance use the word complaint. The federal law, ADEA, and the Title VII use the word charge.
Well, does that mean that complaint means something different in relation to which agency something is being deferred from? Or
no, I don't think it makes any difference at all. I think it could have been more precise drafting to say complaint or charge if they wanted to cover all the possible situations. But complaint, I think, is a generic word for a document filed with the agency seeking to activate the machinery of that agency to redress the claim discrimination. EEOC makes that distinction, but they use the word complaint to mean if somebody writes a letter and says, I think my boss is mistreating me, they don't want to send that off to the employer until they're sure that the employee intends that to be something they want the respondent to receive and to activate the machinery. So they use the two terms. They use complaint to be the first document they receive, and they use charge to be the document that the other two agencies just use the word complaint to describe. That is the document that you send to the employer so that the employer's on notice of what the charge is. It's the initiating document.
I just want, if I may, to follow up on that, because I'm having trouble understanding the underpinnings of the argument with regard to statutory interpretation. I, too, will focus on sub 5. Justice Prosser indicated that when I say statute, I'm talking about the administrative rule, reflects that you can have agreements not just with the feds, but also with a local agency. you indicated that the local agency would have the word complaint, not charge, because the local agency is dealing with Wisconsin law.
That's no, it's because the Madison General Ordinances use the word complaint.
Because what?
Because the Madison General Ordinances use the word complaint. Each entity of government uses has its own nomenclature.
Then I get to my real question. You suggest that the word complaint in sub 5 really means charge because of the agreement, underlying sharing agreement with the feds. Does that mean when we are interpreting a case that would involve a local agency that under their ordinance uses the word complaint, that we then interpret the word complaint to mean complaint, and how can we be defining a statute based on some third-party agreement? I just don't understand that.
Well, the statute, the Fair Employment Act, only talks about the filing of a complaint.
That's right. So why shouldn't complaint mean complaint as opposed to charge? And we know what a complaint requires because the administrative rules set forth in sub 3, form and content of complaint. So we have no problem. We know in Wisconsin what a complaint means, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, if this rule only applies to complaints and only agencies that use that noun and not to a charge, then the agreement with EEOC wouldn't be covered by this. And so filing with EEOC wouldn't be acceptable alternative to filing with the agency.
It's a problem.
It is a problem. That's why we think
this is difficult.
Well, but if we stick with a system where we consider it to be a charge or complaint, and it's been, you know, I've worked for the state for 40 years, and my first job out of law school was working on an EEOC-funded project. I mean, there's cooperation between the state and the federal government on these issues for a long, long time. These work-sharing agreements, you've seen the most recent one, they've been in effect for years, and they've been administered the same way for years. And so that's...
I understand.
It makes good sense for the most part for
everyone. I understand the practicality. I pause at a statutory interpretation analysis that depends on which agreement you're dealing with and appears to be a little contrary to the way we have defined complaint, if you will, in sub 3 of that. So there's a difference between perhaps practicality and legal analysis here.
Well, were the court to conclude that the section only applies to complaints, and I'll leave it to you to figure out what effect that has in this case, then the agency would have the opportunity later to come back and amend its rule to make it complaint or charge so that everyone would be aware. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. Rice. Mr. Reinhart, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
A few comments. With respect to the issue of statutory interpretation, I think the court understands that if you rule in Ms. Aldrich's favor on statutory interpretation, you never get to the issue of issue preclusion. And I understand this argument about it's going to muck up the system years later. You know, somebody might come up. But as a practical matter, in this particular case, it is not a case where 4 years later she would come up, because something was sent from the EEOC to the ERD, so there was actually a case number. The other thing I'd say on that, I had to chuckle a little bit about the comment that, well, the system is all designed so things are bought and resolved quickly. I can tell you, based on good experience, that generally if you file a claim, it's a year, 6 months to a year, before you get a probable cause or no probable cause decision. Then it's usually another 6 months to a year before a hearing is scheduled. Then it's usually another 6 months to a year before a decision is issued by a judge, an administrative law judge. I'd like to speak just a little bit about the Key Up and Mazden cases, because you folks have mentioned them a couple times. it's important to understand what they said and what they didn't say. What they said was, if a charge is considered to be timely filed by the federal agency, then it's okay and it's filed timely with the state agency. What they didn't say and they didn't address is the issue we have here, which is a situation where something's filed, but the federal agency or the federal authorities decide it's not a charge, and you have to do an independent analysis. And that's really why I started by saying this is a case about the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act. We never get to an inconsistent law under the first issue. The first issue, which I think is the important issue, is Wisconsin courts deciding what a Wisconsin statute means. Hulwecki, we obviously have a disagreement about what Hulwecki means. I will say that, just remind the court, that there were two questionnaires that were filed by Ms. Aldrich. One which is a basic questionnaire, and the second which is a charge questionnaire. It's specifically titled charge questionnaire, and it states those actions that you wish to include in the charge. I believe, in fact, that in the Keyup case, I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, the administrator, I think Lurk, found that that did indicate an intent to activate the machinery of the statute. With respect to constructive discharge, I didn't talk about that, but I think it's important because that's an important aspect of her claim. And the contention was, well, she should have submitted it should have been included in her charge because it had occurred at the time the formal charge was signed and sent. And I just remind the court of what actually happened here during that six-month period when she's calling on the phone and saying, what's going on? Where's my charge? Can I get it? And she's informed there's a change in the EOC representative. That's when the constructive discharge occurred and she resigned. And so when she got the formal charge of discrimination, she signed it, but she sent back that document that says more charges of discrimination and described constructive discharge. I don't know what else she could have done. Was she supposed to send it back again and say, oh, by the way, there's additional things that need to be in there and wait another 3 or 4 months? She did what was reasonable. And I would note that's not a new issue that was raised for the first time. It was part of the federal court complaint. It's in the EEOC file, and it's not unusual for if an issue isn't investigated and you get to the hearing, if it's in the complaint, if it's in the documents in the file for the Equal Rights Division judge to send it back and say Lurk needs to, or excuse me, the investigator needs to address it. That's not unusual at all. The question is, what's in the documents that are filed? And if you look at the cases, there's often issues about there's often things about identification of issues, and as long as it's in the complaint and as long as it's properly noticed, that's okay, but they're sometimes sent back.
Do you get to the constructive discharge if you should win on the first item, win on the second issue?
I believe so, and let me tell you why. If you look at Lurk's decision, it said, it didn't say it strongly, well, it suggested if the case was timely filed originally, the original intake questionnaire, then one could conclude that the amendments were timely filed. And I will say that the amendments, the constructive discharge claim, complied with all the requirements for amendments under state law. But if you look at Lurk itself, Lurk suggests that that's appropriate, that if the intake questionnaire complied with the statute of limitations under federal law, then the amendment would too.
If we were to apply issue preclusion, does Lurk then have to decide the issue of timeliness and what is before it? If we were to decide in your client's favor based on issue preclusion, it goes back. Does Lurk then have to decide whether there was a timely complaint before it? Because we're not going to apply it then to the federal decision, and Lurk hasn't made a decision about this yet. At least that was my understanding of the record.
Good question. Arguably, yes. I haven't thought that through. You know, the argument is issue preclusion should be applied. So you're out. If the court says that issue preclusion should not be applied, then we have to look at the timeliness issue. But if the court decides the first issue in our favor.
Well, I'm just asking you about the second issue.
If the court doesn't, if the court decides the first issue in our favor, I don't think so.
Well, I'm not talking about the first issue. I mean, maybe I might agree with you in one issue and not in another. I don't know what my colleagues think about all of this. But I'm just looking at what, you know, what happens if issue preclusion is not applied to the timeliness, which is what we're looking at here.
Well, then
doesn't LURC have to make a decision about that?
Typically, LURC would have to make a decision about that. But then LURC would have to construe the statute, right. I think.
Yep.
And if the court's already construed the statute, then this court, then LURC's not going to construe the statute.
Well, okay. That's one way around the bush. But
well, yeah. the only other thing I'd say is, as we look at the purpose of the statute, the arguments, the position that LURC and Best Buy take is they want to look at form over substance. And I think it was said very well in one of the federal cases that we do not want to have a triumph of form over substance in a statute that's designed to be remedial and for lay people to follow. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank all counsel, Mr. Reinhart, Ms. Jones, and Mr. Rice. Well, excellent briefs and very interesting arguments relating to federal-state relations and discrimination in employment practices. That concludes our hearing in 10AP 1785, Joyce Aldrich versus Labor and Industry Review Commission. The court will take a brief recess, so that the students who wish to leave may do so, and there are additional students who wish to come into the courtroom. We're in recess.